The following Bible study is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
Last time we went through Daniel 9, in which we saw the veracity of God's Word, where Daniel, struggling with the concern he had for his people and praying to God for understanding when would these things that were prophesied by Jeremiah, the 70 years, when would that be up? Then an angel then came to him then and revealed himself to be Gabriel. And the angel then gave him the understanding of when the work would be started, the rebuilding would take place, and when the Messiah would come, and so on. I think it was a fascinating chapter to go through. In chapter 10, we're going to get some insight. The veil is going to be lifted somewhat, and we're going to be able to look into how the angelic realm functions in world affairs. It's a very unique chapter here that in other chapters where we got into the various kingdoms and parts of history and things like that, in this case, we're just going to be introduced. A whole chapter simply introduces the rest of the prophecies that are going to occur in chapter 11 and in chapter 12. So these three chapters should be viewed as a whole, really. But we're going to go through chapter 10 today, and it's a fascinating one. And it's the last vision of Daniel that includes, really, these last three chapters. So let's go to Daniel 10, and we'll begin this. Daniel 10, verse 1. It says, "In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a thing was revealed unto Daniel, whose name was called Belshazzar. And the thing was true, but the time appointed was long, and he understood the thing, and he had understanding of the vision." And so it's believed that the third year of Cyrus here refers to his third year ruling over Babylon, that earlier than that, of course, would be a whole different arena in which probably Daniel wouldn't be that involved. So anyway, it's considered to have been about 535 to 534, that range right there. Daniel explains that in the vision, a thing is revealed to him. And the rest of that chapter then goes through what this thing is. And the revelation comes directly from an angel. And he receives a vision as he had in times past, but this time the vision that he receives, he actually has an angel come to him to explain the meaning of this. And that's what we're going to go through here. Now, in this verse, Daniel explains that his name is Belshazzar as well. And that was, of course, the Babylonian name that was given to him that we read about when we first began the study of Daniel. And I think it's included here for the reason that he intended to publish this in Babylon. And so his name was known there this way. And then he also explains that his name is Daniel because his countrymen would also be reading these prophecies. And so both of these people are addressed, and he then reveals who the author is. And from his statements, I think we see two things. First, he says that it's true. That is, it's absolutely valid. And it's not just his word here, but it's validated by an angel sent from God. It's verified that way. And then he says that the time is very long. It's great and vast. That is, it's going to take place, what we'll see, over a long period of time. We're going to look at Daniel 11, probably the next time we come together for Bible study. We're going to see it goes all the way from that time to the very end of the age when Jesus Christ returns and when the kingdom is established. Now, he makes a funny statement here, doesn't he? He says he understood the thing and had understanding. Sounds kind of awkward at first, but the first word understood means to consider a thing. So Daniel actually considered this thing, this vision that he saw, and he meditated in a very focused way on it, and he was able to understand it finally, of course, because of the angel that came. Anyway, this whole area of time that he covers portends a time of trial and testing for God's people, but it had a profound impact on this man of God, in so much that he mourned over what he realized here. In verse 2 and 3 it says this, "In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks, and I ate no pleasant bread, neither came flesh or wine in my mouth, and neither did I anoint myself at all, till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled." And so when Daniel understood what this vision was, he went into a period of 3 weeks of fasting. The word mourned here is abal in the Hebrew, and it's the kind of mourning that one does when you suffer a loved one's death. That is, he was deeply moved by all of this. And there's a point of interest here that I think is of value, and that is that you notice that Daniel didn't fast, the kind of fast we fast on atonement. That is, he didn't go without food and water totally. This was a partial fast. And I've done this in times past, and other friends of mine have too, that there's occasions where you really can't fast without anything at all. And I would recommend this, because when I was younger, I remember I tried fasting when I went to work because I didn't have a lot of free time. And when I did this, I cut myself really bad on a roof hatch. And the reason was because your blood sugar gets low. And so I suggest that this is a valid thing here. There are times when you can fast partially, that is, go without sometimes solids, just have juices or just have water or something like that. But it is an occasion where it can be dangerous to get your blood sugar too low and to work around machinery, drive cars, that kind of thing. So I bring this out and point this out that in this case, Daniel did not go without food and water totally, but it was a partial fast here that he went through. Now he says he ate no pleasant bread, and I think what he's talking about here is he was actually eating unleavened bread. And I'll show you why later on, because of the time period that he was in. That is, unleavened bread is, of course, the bread of affliction. And it's not the puffed-up kind of sweet bread that we're used to eating, not Wonder Bread, at least. Anyway, further it says that he drank no wine during this period. Now, that's another indicator, just to bring out this, is that you realize that there are various groups out there that say that you can't drink any alcohol. But Daniel says that he drank no wine during this period. It certainly implies that he was used to drinking wine from time to time. And so this is another indicator, this great man of God, a prophet of great esteem, greatly beloved, as we'll see later, actually did drink wine. It is not a sin. What is a sin is to become drunk from drinking alcoholic beverages. And again, then, I'd like us to focus on Daniel here. It says that he was greatly beloved, and I think part of this is because of his care for God, but his care for God's people as well. Here was a man who lived in the luxury of the palace while the rest of his people were captive in that captivity. And it could be easy to become accustomed to living there in that kind of luxury and to not see, as so many people you've noticed, they become wealthy off of others, and they don't see the suffering of others. But Daniel did, and he cared about them and had a deep concern for his own people, and their suffering is what affected him, so much so that he mourned when he realized what was going to happen to the people of God. And so he was very concerned about, if we'll go over to Ezra 4, if you will, Daniel here is very concerned about what is going to happen to his people. In Daniel 9, we saw that he was agonizing about when would we be freed? When would those people be let go? When could they go back and rebuild Jerusalem again? What did Jeremiah mean by this 70 years? And he finds the answer then. Well, here he is again, concerned and asking about the people, because the people were allowed to return in the first year of Cyrus, weren't they? And now it is the third year here. And what's going on is there's trouble. It's not going well. Very few people had returned. Ezra 4, verse 4 and 5, then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah, and they troubled them in building and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose in all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius. And so you understand what was going on, that he was concerned about these people. And here he was again praying, what's going to happen to them? Now, Daniel, by way of example, was a man who cared about the work of God. And we should care about the work of God and what he's doing. We should care about the people of God, deeply care about them, about the modern-day Israel, for instance. In modern-day Joseph now, we are a people who are starting to suffer from terrorism and so on. We've got a lack of ethics and morality that has hit, I think, an all-time low in our country. For the younger of us, why, you probably haven't seen this to the same degree as some of us who are older, but we who were adults back in the 60s and so on, who grew up in the 50s have seen a dramatic change of what America has been going through. And I think it behooves us to be sensitive to it, to care about it. Remember in Ezekiel, it talked about in Ezekiel 9:4, I think it was, where God says to go ahead and mark those people that sigh and cry for the abominations done in Israel. And he was going to protect them. And then he said he was going to go ahead and destroy the others. And he was going to start with the religious leaders. And this is the world, I think, that we live in today. That who sighs and cries for the sins that are done in our society? And you remember in Matthew 5, when Jesus talked about, blessed would be those people who mourn, because they'll be comforted. But he's talking about a people who mourn because of the suffering going on in the world. And we do. We have so much now that we watch on television, and they say, well, hundreds, or in some cases thousands of Taliban are killed. They don't know any better. Do you understand? They're doing, as it said in one television program I saw, the fellows were in jail there, and they were saying, well, we just do what our religious scholars tell us to do. They're trusting in their religious leaders, believing that they're doing this for God. And thousands of them are killed. And pretty soon we get all of this. We go to movies, and we see people chopped in pieces and blown up all the time. And it sort of desensitizes us. So a drive-by killing is fairly no big deal, right? But you understand my point. We begin to get hardened to the suffering that goes on in the world and that we live in. And those special effects, I really believe, that we see in the movies are desensitizing us to such a degree. And the violence that we're seeing in our world, why, when Christ returns, what does he do? He almost destroys the whole planet. I mean, the things that he does, the destruction that comes upon this world is so awesome and so terrifying. But I think it almost has to be, because he's coming back to people that are so desensitized to violence, so desensitized because of the sin in the world that we live in. Matthew 24, verse 12, you might remember this from a sermon I gave a while back. Every night we hear on the news terrible things, and the world that we live in is suffering so badly because of the sin. Matthew 24, and verse 12. Where Jesus says this, as he speaks about the end times, he says, and because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. Well, I'm saying tonight that Daniel is a beautiful example of a servant of God who cared about his people, and that he prayed and he mourned over the suffering that was going on for them. And I'm reminding us, don't let ourselves be calloused into indifference because of the sin that is in this world that we live in. Follow the example of Daniel in compassionate care of others. And to this end, I suggest we should be a people who fast from time to time, because it helps keep our minds in the right perspective. That is, it keeps us humble before God. So, after a while, Daniel 10 again, Daniel is visited by an angel. Verse 4, and in the 4th and 20th day of the first month, as I was by the side of the great river, which is, anyway, 10 days after Passover, is when he's talking about here. It was 3 days after the last day of unleavened bread. So you can see why I suggest that, in all likelihood, he was not eating pleasant bread, but was in all likelihood eating unleavened bread here. It was just after the Passover when this is all going to occur. And so he was by this great river that is actually the Tigris River. And many people would suggest reasons for why he was there. Maybe he was on a governmental mission of some sort. But I really don't think so. I think Daniel at this time was at the end of his life. And I would suggest this, that he was probably retired from governmental service. But I would suggest that he went here to expressly for the purpose of praying to God to receive an answer and to keep God's holy days. Remember, Paul went out to the river, and that's where they met. There were a number of places throughout the Bible where God's prophets would go to a river, and that's where they would often preach or teach that kind of thing. So, for whatever it's worth, there's a lot of different ideas about this, but I don't think he was on a governmental mission out here. I think he was out here expressly for the purpose of fasting before God. In the case of Terry's reading, I think he made a good comment, and services where he would have in all likelihood shown these leaders that came in from Persia, those prophecies that the people were to be let go and so on. And so there would be some of that time. But after that, I think Daniel kind of drops out from this. Now, next we see probably one of the most detailed descriptions of an angel in the Bible in Daniel 10 and verse 5 and 6. Daniel 10, verse 5 and 6. Then I lifted up mine eyes, and behold, he looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose loins were girded with fine gold of Uphaz. His body was also like beryl, his face as the appearance of lightning, and his eyes as lamps of fire, and his arms and his feet like in color to polished brass, and the voice of his words like the voice of a multitude. And so the angel here appears to him like a man, and he wore white linen. Now, I believe that this white linen clothing was probably radiating and shining, resplendent, shimmering in as it radiated light out. And I say this because if you remember when the two angels there after Christ's resurrection, it actually said that that the two men stood by in shining garments. And so those angels had shining garments, and so he points out this linen that he's wearing. And so I think you could put those two together and say it probably had a pretty awesome effect here. And here it says the angel's loins were girt about with gold. And I think that this was probably either some sort of gold band. Have you ever seen where they embroider gold, a belt, where they'll actually, it almost looks like it's braided? Have you seen any of that in the gold shops? It's very beautiful, but they make very fine threads of gold, and then they put them together, and it's embroidered. It's beautiful. And I see this probably as a large belt around him. But his body also glowed with a luminescence here. And it talks about beryl. It's kind of a yellowy look to it. But it's, again, if you can think of this brass that's polished to a really high polish, it's probably what you're looking at here with light radiating from even the skin. And his face is like lightning. That is, I see this in terms of the flash of lightning that you see. And his voice like a great multitude. Now, over in Revelation, it speaks of Christ in a very similar way. And I'd like to pop over there, if we could, Revelation 1. Because you'll read commentaries or you'll hear people say that they believe that this being that appears to him is actually Jesus Christ. And there is some similarity here in chapter 1 of Revelation, in verse 14 and 15, where it speaks of Jesus this way, his head and his hairs were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were as a flame of fire, and his feet like undefined brass, as if they burned in a furnace, and his voice is the sound of many waters. And so some would make a comparison here, but I want to suggest to you that it's not Jesus Christ that's appearing to him here. It's an angel. And remember this, that Christ's eyes are like fire. His face is like looking into the blinding light of the sun, not like a flash of lightning. And his feet are like burning brass rather than just the brass that we see here. But it does say his voice is like many waters. But you'll see in verse 11 this. It shows that this being was first sent by God. In verse 13, he's in a battle with the prince of Persia, it says, and Michael, the angel, has to come to help him. You understand, if it was Christ, I don't think an angel would have to come to help him, that he'd need help from, you know, calling for help or something. That we see Jesus Christ returns to the earth, and we see the very heavens flee away from him, and we see that he binds Satan fairly easily, and that a strong angel puts him in this pit. And so I see the differences here. You see that the angel has a belt around his loins. Christ has a girdle around his breasts that is of gold. And so I see these differences. And so I think that we can say that it is probably not Jesus Christ here that's appearing, but an angel. But these verses show us something that I want to point out that to me is of great significance. That is, we're able to look into a little bit, a glimpse of what the spirit world is really like. And there's similarities between Jesus Christ and the angel here that appears as a man. We're made in God's image. And so the angel appearing as a man looks somewhat like Jesus Christ. But there's a glory to the angelic world here. Various men and women, when they've seen angels, what have they done? Fall down to worship, haven't they? They've been so awestruck by what they see. And this angel appears, and his appearance shakes Daniel down to his core. And I would say this. Have you ever heard of people saying that an angel came to them? You ever heard like Protestant ministers teaching, and they say that an angel spoke to them, or they said this or that to them? Well, I think there's an interesting test here. Look at how this angel shakes Daniel, how it overwhelms him. Does this happen to these people that have angels speak to them? Or are they relatively unshaken by the experience? But you look at human beings, and there's often a dignity there among many. There's a beauty among many. But you understand that as a human being, we have to attend to our beauty or we lose it. We get dirt under our nails. We have various bodily functions that are kind of icky sometimes. And eventually we get old, like Anne. You know, living with Anne, I'm watching her on her way to death. And, her flesh is beginning to smell. She's experiencing gangrene, and some of her is rotting away as she lives. But that's what we're made of, flesh and blood, you see. There's a big difference between us and the angels. And we need a change. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 15, verse 51. We need to be changed. Chapter 15 and verse 51, "Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, that is, remain in the grave, dead, but we shall all be changed." Yes, the physical world is not the real world, is it? It seems like it's the real world, but the real world is the spirit world. This one is only temporary. Everything in time is going to flatline. Every sun goes dark. That we have to be changed. And one day we'll be able to be in this world that is a spirit world. It is the real one. It's eternal. It's glorious. And it's where we want to invest our lives. Anyway, this is what we're going to look forward to eventually. In verse 35 of this same chapter, it says this, "But some men will say, how are the dead raised up? And with what body do they come?" Well, this is a great question. And then in verse 39 through 41, it says this, and speaking about what kind of body we'll have. "All flesh is not the same flesh, but there's one kind of flesh of men, another flesh of beasts, another of fishes, and another of birds. There are also celestial bodies and body terrestrial, but the glory of the celestial is one, and the glory of the terrestrial is another. And then there's one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, another glory of the stars. For one star differs from another star in glory. So also is the resurrection of the dead, sown in corruption and raised in incorruption." And this is something that I want us to think about. There is, among the animal kingdom, there are different kinds of glories, aren't there? And I remember looking at one time down at Burke Engineering where I used to go buy parts, and they had a couple of these animals, you know, that they stuff, and they put their heads on the wall, and they had there a ram, and then they had a boar's head. And it was really interesting to look at the two. There was a nobility to the ram, a dignity to the ram, and the boar was just brutish. It was very different. You understand, there's a different glory for in the different animal worlds. And I would suggest this too, that we're made in the image of God. And then there's other images that you could possibly be made in. And that is this. We see in the other scriptures where we see spirit beings that are angelic beings that don't look like a man, but they have hoods. They have wings, don't they? They have the face of an eagle, the face of an ox, and so on. And so there are different images to be in. And there are different glories within wherever you're born, whether we're in human or whether we're animals or whatever. Differences in the sun and moon and differences in the stars. Let's go back to verse 42. This is how what it's like in the resurrection of the dead, sown in corruption and raised in incorruption, sown in dishonor, raised in glory, sown in weakness, and raised in power. It's sown a natural body and raised a spiritual body. There is a natural body, the one we have now, and there is a spiritual body. 2 Corinthians, if you will, 2 Corinthians 5. And so I remind us of this. Christ appears here different than the angel. Christ is different. he has more glory. It's not the face that you look in and see lightning. It's the face that looks like the blinding sun, which if you look at will take out your rods and cones in short order. There's so much power there in the sun. So he's more glorious than the angel. And so I remind us of this. We're going to have a spirit body, but it's not going to be a spirit body like the angels. It's going to be a spirit body much like God. 2 Corinthians 5:10 says this, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that every one may receive the things done in his body according to what he's done, whether it be good or bad." And so you understand why I'm reading this. We're going to appear before Christ's judgment seat, and there'll be changes made in our spirit body according to our reward. That we're all saved and we have eternal life as a free gift, but we're rewarded according to our works. And so I'm suggesting here that we're not going to look like angels, that we're going to look like God looks and be made in his image finally spiritually. And so we're made lower than the angels now, but eventually we're going to be over angels. He even says that we'll judge angels. And so we are going to have the awesome beauty, the majesty, the glory that God has now. He's going to share with that. One day radiating in beauty and majesty, far greater than even this angel that appears to Daniel. And I want to remind us in this Bible study then, let's never forget that it says the first resurrection is a better resurrection. Let's always keep that in mind and remember that we're building, if you will. You understand, I was born the way I was. I never was too happy. I wish I could have been taller. I wish I could have had a faster metabolism, been more handsome. But I didn't have any say-so in the body, did I, that I have now. But God, it seems, is saying that he'll give us a body according to what we've done in this life. So the more good we do, the better people we are. Doesn't it seem then that you could even have a part in the body that you'd have? It'll make a difference in how you live right now. So anyway, don't forget and let this be something that motivates us towards the kingdom of God. The beauty and majesty he promises we'll one day have. Back to Daniel 10 and verse 7 this time. "And I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, for the men that were with me saw not the vision, but a great quaking fell upon them, so that they fled to hide themselves." So the others that were there with him didn't see the vision, but they sensed the presence of this angelic being, and they felt the terror. And this is what it's like to be in the presence of righteousness. It is sometimes a very frightening thing. And many times when the angels appeared or when God appeared to various prophets, they were afraid of him. And in many cases, they didn't want anything to do. Remember what Isaiah said? "Woe, I'm undone. I'm a man of unclean lips." And immediately in the presence of righteousness, you begin to feel your own sense of unworthiness. And I think that he felt some of that as well, and these others felt it as well, the awesome dread of the power of righteousness. And so, remember this, when the scriptures speak of Christ's return, what do men do? They run to hide in the dens of the rocks, to hide themselves from this being. And I don't think it's just the fact that they're afraid of the power, because I've had my own experience with God, where it's frightening to be that close to that being that is so holy and so perfectly good that it makes us sometimes feel terrible in the presence of righteousness. So anyway, additionally, well, it was only Daniel that saw the vision. And you notice that God often works this way. There's a couple other cases where Elisha saw the angelic host circling Dothan. And in another case, Paul, remember at his conversion experience where God appears to him. And everything, why, in that case, Paul's companions, they heard a voice, but they didn't see the vision, but Paul did see it. Anyway, next Daniel explains the effect of this vision here in verse 8 and 9. "Therefore I was left alone," he said, "and I saw this great vision, and there remained no strength in me, for my comeliness was turned in me into corruption, and I retained no strength. Yet I heard the voice of the words, and when I heard the voice of his words, then was I in a deep sleep on my face, and my face towards the ground." And so I think he had an experience somewhat like the Apostle John, where he saw the throne of God there, and he said, I fell at his, as if dead. That this was so powerful an experience that he actually passed out, became unconscious there. And the angel then raises him up and speaks to him in verses 10 and 11. And behold, the hand touched me, which set me upon my knees and upon the palms of my hands. And he said unto me, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto you, and stand upright. For unto you am I now sent. And when he had spoken this word unto me, I stood trembling. And so the angel here touches Daniel to strengthen him. And he'll do this three other times in this chapter. But there's something about touch, isn't there? Ever thought about that? Something about touch that is rejuvenating, even when we touch one another. We hug sometimes. We'll just put our arm around one another. You can feel a transfer taking place, can't you? Of affection or love. And in the Bible, we see that this is something that takes place. A transfer of love, a transfer of healing, a transfer of the Holy Spirit. When we're baptized, remember how it says that you should have hands laid on you to receive the Holly Spirit. And over again, Christ laid his hands on people to heal them. He blessed the little children by laying his hands on them. It was a case where hearing was given to somebody. Sight given to another. Another who was dumb was able to speak. And in every case, Christ touched them. He stretched out his hand to touch and heal the leper. Can you imagine that? An untouchable. A man whose skin is rotting off his body. Jesus Christ touches him. And he's healed. Anyway, Daniel stands upright, respectively, and attentive, and he stands there trembling. And again, to me, this is insight into what it's like to be in the presence of the spirit world. That these beings are awesome and terrible, frightening to those who of us who are just human. So it causes us to tremble. But the angel here reassures him and says, "You are greatly beloved." And the word here means precious to God. And Daniel had a unique place, position with God, a certain status, you might say. We're all loved by God. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, and so on. And I believe this, if you or I were the only persons on the face of the earth, Jesus Christ would love us enough to give his life. He would die for just us if we were the only ones. But then again, there is a difference, too. You remember the case of the Apostle John, who put his head on Christ's chest? And you remember the scriptures say, the apostle that Jesus loved. Well, I think there was a position that Daniel had much like that. And why? Why, though? I really believe it was because of the way Daniel was. Daniel 2, and 3, and 4, and 5, 6, and 7 that we've read over and over again. What did we see about Daniel? A man totally devoted to God. A man who, no matter what position he found himself in, whatever circumstance, he wasn't going to be swayed one way or another. He was going to pray, even if it meant his death. It didn't matter to him. He was going to obey God no matter what. And we also saw a man that humbly cared about others so much so that he actually saved all the soothsayers and the astrologers and all the magicians and everything else. By giving the interpretation to the king. And all of those men were saved. And he just seemed to be a humble, sincerely devoted man to God, that he was a servant of God, and therefore he would do God's will under every condition. And that's why I say that one of the things about reading Daniel, I think, is the striking example of him. You read the book of Acts, and you see Paul beaten, flogged, stoned, left for dead. You see these great heroes of faith. Well, Daniel is one of them. He really is a great man of God, humbly submitting in every circumstance, even when the circumstances are bad, kept God's law, ever striving to be led by the Spirit of God. Daniel 10, the angel continues to reassure him here, and he says, and he said unto me, that is Daniel, fear not, Daniel, from the first day that you did set your heart to understand and to chasten yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I'm come for your words. And so here is a scene from behind the scenes of the supernatural. When he prayed a number of times. But from the very first time he prayed, God heard him and responded. And in another place, Jesus said what? He said God knows what we ask even before we ask. Well, we go to God to ask for it so that we know who it is that gives us our blessings. But the point is this. He was fasting and praying here, and I think there's a valid point to be made about this. And that is that, you remember in one case the disciples couldn't cast out a demon? And they went to him and they said, why couldn't we do this? And he said, well, this one only goes out by prayer and fasting. Well, the reason fasting helps so much is because, again, it puts us in a right perspective. We're just physical. We depend on food. We depend on air. We have to have water or we're going to die. And all we have to do is just go one day without any of those things. I mean, we need air. But you understand my point. One day without food and water, and we start going through withdrawals, and our blood sugar drops into our socks, and we realize we're just temporary. We just need God. And it helps put us in a right perspective. And then also, when you come away from fasting, have you ever noticed this? I mean, I'm not sure how you experience this, but after you come out of your fast and you begin to eat and your strength comes back, that's a beautiful feeling too. And I always feel really close to God, feeling the strength coming back, and I feel a certain sense of appreciation and gratitude. I think it's a wonderful tool that God has given us to help be closer to Him. So anyway, when God answers our prayers, He doesn't always answer with yes. That sometimes the answer that He gives, and He gives that answer sometimes the first moment we begin to pray. He already knows what we're going to ask, and He already knows what He's going to do. And sometimes the answer is wait. Sometimes we're too immature to have those things that we might ask Him for, and it might do us damage to suddenly win the lottery, as it has done a number of people. But other times, the answer simply may be no. And it was that way to Paul, wasn't it? He said no, that, you know, my strength is sufficient for you. And in case of Christ, when he prayed, he said, is there any other way this cup can pass? Well, nevertheless, not my will, but yours. So there's times when God says no to us. And there's times when God said no to Daniel. But Daniel, of course, was the kind of man, and the kind of man we should be, that we accept what God does in our lives. We ask for what we want, but we accept. And as Paul said, he was content in whatsoever state he found himself. And sometimes it wasn't always good, but he knew this. It would all work for his good, one way or the other. And we can trust God in this, I believe, completely. So anyway, the book of James tells us the effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. And his prayer was effective. And when God began to answer his prayer, you see, there were incredible forces that were unleashed. And I think sometimes you and I will pray and we sometimes even we receive a yes answer. We don't realize what happened behind the scenes in order for that prayer to be answered. But there are great things and events going on. So anyway, the angel explains to Daniel what occurred here in verse 13. He said that his words were heard from the beginning of the time he began to pray, but 3 weeks went by. And then he says, but the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. But lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia. And when Daniel prayed, God's response was immediate. But even so, it seems the forces of evil can delay a delivery of answers to our prayers. And this was the case here, where it talks about a prince of Persia. And I believe that this prince of Persia was not the human prince. And I think Clark's commentary says that it was just the human leader there. But I think it was more than that. And I believe this, that there are demons out there that are Satan's agents, and that they are the ones that inspire world rulers in many cases and influence rulers around the world. And I think that Satan did not want this information made available to the public, that is Daniel 11, because this is a conclusive proof to anybody that would question the authenticity of God's word. that these prophecies have been fulfilled and will be fulfilled, and we're on the very verge of the climactic end. But they're so clear and so obvious that it validates the truth of God. And so I think Satan didn't want this information to be made available, and so he fought against this. I think it was spiritual wickedness in high places that he was dealing with. Anyway, it's been a case, I think, that many have believed this, that the various nations that are out there have spirits that preside over them. Satan having perhaps demons assigned to different nations. And we've seen cases where there are guardian angels. That is in the case of when Peter was imprisoned. And remember that Peter was freed and came to the house and they said, oh, it's his angel. And so many have thought there were guardian angels like that. But many have thought and believe this, that the various wars that take place on earth are reflective of wars that are actually taking place in the heavens, and that the earth's history can be found in heavenly events then. But I think it gives us insight and understanding into realizing who rules this world. That when Jesus Christ was tempted, he actually was offered the kingdoms of this world by Satan. And I think that was because these kingdoms are his. And I want you to think about this for a minute, the world we live in. The terrible poverty that you see in Africa when you see these children that World Vision shows in Ethiopia and other places, where does that come from? It's not God's world, is it? The poverty and want in the former USSR, the terrible living conditions that we see in China, in India. Now, those people, they worship a god where they drink urine and pour cow dung on their heads. Can anything be more ridiculous? You understand, where does this come from? Not from human beings. This has to be some kind of inspiration from beings that are more depraved than even human beings are. In Ezekiel 28, it speaks about the prince of Tyre there. And then it changes and it lifts from the prince of Tyre to actually Satan himself. It becomes clear that Satan is the one that is moving various armies and forces around the world. And so I believe that it is that fallen angels do influence world leaders. I want you to think about how brutal why these world leaders have been throughout history. I want you to think about the power that Adolf Hitler had. You understand, that man didn't have any charisma of himself. He wasn't good looking. He wasn't a really great speaker or anything. He wasn't a likable man. Where did he get the power to lead an entire nation the way he did and to control people? I mean, the just unbelievable power that the man had. It had to come from forces beyond just his own human abilities. I know I was reading a story, too, about Saddam Hussein. And some of his top lieutenants have, of course, defected. But one of them said, I wanted to kill him so bad. And he said, I tried repeatedly. And he said, one time he was 6 feet away, I pulled out my gun and I was going to shoot him and something stopped me. How is it? How is it we can send a missile over to hit the training camp with Osama bin Laden there and he somehow moved out of there an hour before? You understand what I'm getting at? That these leaders that are so brutal and terrorist in nature, They seem to have charmed lives in many cases. I'm not saying that they won't find their end, but how is it that they live this long when they're this way? Well, I say it's the reason is because of this that we're talking about. They're the Prince of Persia or the other princes, the demonic forces that influence them around the world. Remember we bombed Muammar Gaddafi's home and another case, he was gone. And I wouldn't be surprised if we don't get Osama bin Laden here, or that some of his lieutenants get away, because of who they're in league with. They're in league with evil. So anyway, I say this, invisible battles going on in the spirit world that we're unaware of. And in another case, why Jesus told Peter, he said, Satan wants to sift you like wheat. And he could have, and would have, if Christ hadn't prayed for him. Other cases, Michael disputing with Satan about the bones of Moses. So much more going on behind the scenes, and we'd like to read Ephesians 6 here that we had in a sermon from Randy a while back. I thought was very effective. Ephesians 6. What's going on here really? What's going on here really behind the scenes that we don't see all the time? And it's this, Ephesians 6, verse 11 and 12. Where we're admonished to put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. And so often we think that the battle is with our boss. We think the battle is with our neighbor that doesn't like us. A co-worker we can't seem to get along with. You understand what I'm saying? We think that the battle is with people. But the battle isn't always with people. That often it is with attitudes that are being broadcast by the prince of the power of the air. So anyway, God sometimes allows, I believe, the demonic forces in the world to express their rebellion in certain ways, just like he allows us to do, doesn't he? We're allowed to. He doesn't make us obey him in every case. And we see, however, this, that in the case of Job, we see that God said to Satan, you can go this far and no further. Now, while these beings have great powers, they are very limited directly by God. And so there are cases where, and I want to make this point on the other side, because this angel was delayed in bringing a message to Daniel, wasn't he? But what if you're in trouble somewhere? You really, you know, a car's coming right at you. You are now just dead meat unless God intervenes. Do you think that angel would be delayed? No. No. Remember the men in the fiery furnace? The angel was right there, taking care of them. I want to make this point here, that Paul says, I'm persuaded neither death nor life, angels, principalities, or any of those things can separate us from the love of God. There's no way this is going to happen. And he says in another place that no temptation has taken you that isn't common to man, but God will provide a way of escape. That God monitors us, we have angels watching over us, and he will protect us. The issue here was a case of a message, and I believe a message that he wanted a specific angel to deliver. And I'll get to that a little bit later. In other words, I'm addressing why is it that this angel was able to be deterred for a certain amount of time, and yet we see in other cases angels are right there, right at the moment. You see what I'm getting at? I don't want us to think for a minute that God is somehow limited. God has all the power in the universe. There isn't anything he can't do, and there isn't anybody he can't save. And the instant you need help, God would be there. And he will be there, and is there, and has been there, and historically. But I'm suggesting this, that in this case, God was answering a prayer of Daniel, and I believe God desired a specific angel to come and to give him the message. Well, what angel would it be? Let me back up just a little bit, too, because there are various people that would say that this angel was Gabriel, because it was actually Gabriel who revealed himself coming to Daniel in the previous chapter. But you understand, if it was Gabriel, don't you think he'd recognize him? Don't you think he would say the angel that came in the other chapter, or he would say Gabriel who came to me before, or something like that? I think he probably would have been that. Gabriel is the angel that stands before God, and he has the responsibility, it seems, for being the angel who gives messages from God. And he's the one that appeared to Mary and Joseph and those people then. But I think it wasn't in this case because of this. I think that this was the angel who had the responsibility for making sure that the prophecies were fulfilled in the Middle East. And we'll see later, he says, after this is taken care of, then the prince of Greece is going to come. Because I think he was the one that was the one responsible for ensuring that God's prophecies would be fulfilled. He was the one for responsible to make sure that Cyrus was going to let these people go, and that this was going to happen, and that was going to happen the way God had said. And so he had the angel who responsible for all these prophecies that would take place not just then, but all the way through the chapter 11, all the way through all those events that would happen in the Middle East, all the way to the end. So it's just a speculation on my part why this angel would not be Gabriel, why this angel would not be, why this angel would be specifically the one God used and why it would be that he would come even though he was detained by this conflict with the Prince of Persia. I'm making myself clear at all. Okay. I'm not sure. I felt like I did a pretty poor job on that. But I wanted to at least voice it. So anyway, I want to talk just a little bit about, you know, we don't see how these battles are fought. We don't see the weapons that are used so much. But I want us to realize that there are wars going around. There are conflicts going around, and there are pressures on us sometimes to sin, to break ranks with God, and those pressures are going on all the time. And there are angelic forces out there that it is a war that we have to go through. And we're not sure, we don't see the bullets in this case, but these incredible spirit beings are powerful. And I really believe, and I don't know how you feel about this, but there are science fiction movies or science fiction books. And have you ever noticed how sometimes they touch very close to the truth? I've often wondered if sometimes these science fiction writers aren't inspired by some sort of spirit out there or something. But have you noticed that in the movies today, what do you see? You see these superhuman, supernaturally powerful heroes, don't you? Remember in The Matrix, this guy eventually is able to stop bullets, or you can be shot and they just pierce right through you and you just keep right on going, like in The Highlander. But you understand why I'm saying this is, think about the spiritual battles that might be going on. What would it be like, angelic beings that can't die, fighting one another? And I know they show in the movies, they show this guy is thrown right through a concrete wall, right? And then he gets up and he fights some more. And it seems a little ridiculous to us. But on the other hand, what would it be like in the angelic realm if they were fighting? Because you remember it says that there's the case of Satan attacks God's throne at the end of the age again, and he's cast back down again. There are wars going on. There are battles, and they've got to be awesome when you consider the magnificence of these beings compared to us. Why, what's it like? I don't know. But sometimes I think of these things about the science fiction writers and some of the things that we see. Where do they get these ideas? And could some of these ideas somehow help you understand what it might be like? Spirit means it can't die in conflict and war. So anyway, we also see that there are principalities and powers and so on. So you get the impression that there are domains, don't you? There are domains and there's regions and things like that and different ranks of angelic beings that are in the dark side and so on. So anyway, I want to bring out this other thing about Daniel, that he prayed and fasted for 21 days. And again, his example is one of continued, undiscouraged perseverance, isn't it? It's a beautiful example. It really is. 21 days before he finally came. And his example to us is, I think, profound and valid. That if we're praying for something and we don't receive it, shouldn't we keep on praying? Yes, keep on praying. It doesn't mean God has said no at all. And Jesus gave the example of the widow lady who went to the unjust judge. And here she just kept repeatedly going back until he finally caved in. And he gave that as an example for us. And he said to continue to pray and don't let down. Don't stop praying. So if you don't have the answer, remember this example here of Daniel and continue to pray. So finally, in this verse that we read, it says that the angel came and Michael had to assist him. And then he remained with the prince of Persia, or the princes of Persia. Doesn't that seem awkward, wording, sort of like, well, wait a minute, Michael came to help me, but then I remained there with the kings of Persia, is what it sounds like he's saying, but it's not saying that at all. This word remained is yathar in the Hebrew, and it means just over or to exceed. The implication means to excel. So the impression you get is that Michael came, then I excelled over the prince of Persia. And that is, I won, and we stayed him, and then he was able to come while Michael was able to handle things there. So anyway, this magnificent angel that is personally, back to Daniel 10, supervising Persia, comes to Daniel. And he speaks these words in verse 14. Now I am come to make you understand what shall befall your people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days. And so the angel comes to reveal what's going to happen to God's people in the latter days. And so while some might think this is just talking about Antiochus Epiphanes and so on, I don't think it is. I think it's going to go all the way to the end, to Christ's return and the establishment of the kingdom of God. And then in verse 15, when he had spoken such words unto me, I set my face towards the ground and I became dumb. And so he bowed himself down, I think, in respect and remained dumb, that is, speechless. He was unable to speak at this time. And so again, the angel reaches down and touches him. Then behold, it says in verse 16, one like the similitude of the sons of men touched my lips. And then I opened my mouth and spoke and said unto him that stood before me, O my Lord, by the vision my sorrows are turned upon me, and I have retained no strength. And so you can see again that he's just so deeply moved by this. He's really shaken by the whole thing. So in verse 17, how can the servant of this my Lord talk with this my Lord? For as for me, straightway there remained no strength in me, neither is there any breath left in me. And so here it really should be translated, how can I talk with you, my Lord, would probably be a better example of what he's trying to say here. It really sounds awkward in the King James. And then in verse 18, then there came again and touched me one like the appearance of a man, and he strengthened me, and he said, O man, greatly beloved, fear not. Peace be unto you. Be strong. Yes, be strong. And when he had spoken unto me, I was strengthened and said, Let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. And so again, the angel touches him and strengthens Daniel, and he's reminded that he's, of course, I think, strengthened and encouraged emotionally too as well, that he's greatly beloved. And he's reminded to be strong, much like that God reminded Joshua when he told him of the job he was going to have to do, that he said, be strong and be of great courage. So he gives him further strength, and so Daniel asks him to speak on then, and he says, do you know wherefore I have come unto you? And now will I return to fight with the prince of Persia, and when I am gone forth, lo, the prince of Grecia shall come. And so the angel explains that he's still in combat, that he still has to fight with this, I believe, demonic force assigned to Persia, but he would need to return to ensure that the returning Jews would be, in fact, successful and that all was going to go well. But once this assignment was complete, why, the Prince of Greece was going to come. And, of course, Daniel, I think, was familiar with this, and that was at the original scenario that he had given. And you can kind of see this, I think, in Daniel 2. Certain amount is revealed, and we see these various kingdoms. Daniel 7, again, we get a portion of those kingdoms shown, perhaps without the Roman kingdom being viewed. But you get a piece of this. Now what we're going to get is the whole enchilada, in a sense. It's going to be unfolded in much more detail at this time, that there would be a prince of Persia that would come, a kingdom of Persia. And then finally, that would be followed by the kingdom of Greece. And then the angel is going to go through this. And he says, but I'll show you that which is noted in the scripture of truth. And there is none that holds with me in these things, but Michael, your prince. And so, anyway, we're going to then go into chapter 11 next, and we'll go into a great deal of detail about the prophecies from that time forward until Christ returns. And, of course, this can be read in on the website in a, what I think is a pretty good book, The Middle East and Prophecy, if anybody's had a chance to read that.